If you have a Bible or a way to access your Bible today, we're going to be in John's Gospel. We're going to be in the 13th chapter. Just a moment, I want to read verses 31 and 38. Today we're starting a new series. We're calling this Undeniable Truths. And we've been working through John's Gospel, but we're in this new section of the Gospel. Right before Easter, we had kind of finished at that place where Jesus was at the Last Supper, and you know, he'd washed the disciples' feet, and then he'd shared in that meal with them, and he said that one of them would betray him, and the one that would dip the bread in the cup. And then it was Judas, of course, who did that. Well, that text ends there, and it says that as Judas had taken the bread, he went out, and it was night. And so this, as we begin reading this passage, you can already feel the mood in the passage. It's not just that it was night time, it wasn't just what hour it was night in the sense that a darkness had come over everything that was happening. I mean, this was the night that Jesus would be arrested. By morning, he'd be on a cross. And so there's a sense of foreboding about this moment, an inevitability about what was taking place. And the text picks up in verse 31. It says, when he was gone, and the he there is Judas, Jesus said, now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself and glorify him at once. My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You'll look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now. Where I'm going, you cannot come. He's going to the cross. But then he says this in verse 34 and 35, and it's an incredible words that he speaks here. He says, a new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know you're my disciples if you love one another. Simon Peter asked him, Lord, where are you going? And Jesus replied, well, where I am going, you cannot follow me. You will follow me later. A lot of us know what he's talking about there. He's going to go to the cross, and Peter's not going to go to the cross at first, but later on, Peter will die, according to tradition, on a cross. Peter asked him, well, Lord, why can't I follow you now? I'll lay down my life for you. And Jesus answered, will you really lay down your life for me? Very truly, I tell you, before the rooster crows, you'll disown me three times. You know, this passage of Scripture is really an incredible passage. Jesus is talking about what's about to happen, how he's going to go to the cross, where he is going. But then he interrupts this with a statement about this new command I give you. The disciples, though, all they want to know is, where are you going? What are you going to do? And they sort of bypass this whole command in verses 34 and 35. A new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. When the Bible was translated into the official language of Rome, the Latin language, the words for a new command were mandatum novum. And in fact, whenever they would remember this new command Jesus gave, the novum mandatum, and Christians would celebrate together the Last Supper, that Thursday night became known as Maundy Thursday. And perhaps you've heard of churches that celebrate. We've done that before on Thursday night, have a Maundy Thursday service. And that word Maundy means a command, a new command that Jesus gives at this Last Supper meal. And the whole command is about love. And you know, we live in a culture today that talks, you know, a lot about love, and we think about love and what is love, and there's songs about love and everything's about love. But what is love? Well, you know, I saw someone, read where someone sent a love letter to their former boyfriend. They had broken off the engagement, and this young lady wrote to Jimmy. She said, dearest Jimmy, I like that, dearest. No words could ever express the great unhappiness I've felt since breaking our engagement. Please say you'll take me back. No one could ever take your place in my heart, so please forgive me. I love you. I love you. I love you. Yours forever. P.S. Congratulations on winning the state lottery. Well, that may be one form of love, right? But that's not what most of us think of when we think of love. Love, well, if your circumstances change, I think now I love you. That's kind of the way a lot of people do love, I guess. But what Jesus is saying here is, I'm giving you a new command, a mandatum novum, a new understanding, a new expression of what love is. And he begins to explain what that is. But before we can go too far into this, I just have to tell you, and maybe you're following along, you want to fill in the blanks, you want to stay awake through this sermon, this short sermon. We just maybe fill in the blank. This is the first thing I want you just to kind of notice in this passage. And that is the misconceptions, right? I mean, even as I was reading that this week and kind of getting ready for the sermon, I was thinking to myself, you know, it's real easy to misunderstand what Jesus means right here. Because you're reading this and he says, okay, a new command I give you. Well, this is the misconception, is that he's really giving a new command about love. But here's the truth. The command to love here is not new, is it? I mean, the Bible talks about love. It starts out nearly at the beginning of the Bible. In fact, two of the most famous verses, maybe even in the Bible, on love are in the Old Testament. One of them is in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18. It's where Leviticus says, don't hold a grudge against somebody, specifically your neighbor. Love your neighbor as yourself. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. And notice how it ends. I am the Lord. I'm the Lord your God. I'm the God that brought you out of Egypt, and I command you, love your neighbor as yourself. And everybody knows that. That's a very important passage on love in the Bible. The other one is Deuteronomy 6:5. Love the Lord your God. It's that vertical love with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your strength. You know, Jesus quotes those verses quite often. Paul does. The Bible says you can summarize the entire law, all of the commandments, in those two words, love God and love your neighbor. The vertical relationship and the horizontal relationship. So why is Jesus saying, I'm giving you a new command? I mean, this is the most famous command of them all, isn't it? Well, it's not that the command to love is new, but the kind of love commanded here is. The kind of love that's being described here is a different expression of love. In the Old Testament, God would say, I command you love. But here Jesus is saying, I want you to love as I've loved you. In fact, the verse we preached from last Sunday on Easter was that passage in John 15:3 where he says, greater love has no one than this. I mean, the ultimate expression of love, to lay down one's life for one's friends. In other words, Jesus isn't just commanding love or talking about love. Jesus is exemplifying love, or number two, he's giving us the model of love. What real love looks like is what Jesus is doing for us. In John 15:12, my command is this, love each other as I have loved you. How did Jesus love them? What did Jesus do? He didn't just wash their feet. He went to the cross and he died. And so what he's showing us here is, I mean, let's be honest, this is a new standard of love. This is a new definition of love. This is a new high of what love is. The novum mandatum is the mandate that is itself the model that exemplifies what real love looks like. Let's try to just kind of put this in context. What did this look like in that world? I mean, after all, the Jewish people for many, many centuries had the law, and they knew that they were supposed to love God and love each other. Well, one witness in the time of Jesus, one historian by the name of Cornelius Tacitus, tells us about what the Jewish people were like. He talks about all different events that happened in the Roman Empire. And one of the things is he talks about the Jewish people. And in one of his statements is he talks about how the Jewish people were very compassionate and loyal to one another. And he makes this statement about them. He says, you know, the Jews are loyal toward one another, but other people, they only hate. Now, that's a very interesting observation, isn't it? I mean, he was a pagan. He didn't know anything about all of what was going on in Judaism, but from the outside, he could look in and he could see how the Jewish people, how they were loving each other and how compassionate and loyal they were to each other. But he also noticed how they treated every other group on the planet. He noticed that. Now, there was another guy who was an observer of all this, and he was a Christian pastor named Tertullian. He's one of the most famous of the early church fathers. And he made the comment about how pagans saw Christians. And it's a very different description. He said that the pagans marveled at Christians in the face of persecution as they were dying for their faith. He said, quote, "See how they love, how they are ready even to die for one another." In other words, the Christians were doing something that nobody else was doing. The Christians had put into practice an example that they had seen in Jesus that didn't look like anything else that anybody had ever done before, anybody had ever even heard of before. Now listen, we all know this verse. If you've been around the Bible, around church or read the Bible very much, you know this teaching about love. And let's be honest, this is a very simple thing to know about. It's very simple to say, but let's be honest, it's pretty hard to do, isn't it? I mean, loving like Jesus talks about here, it's simple to say, but it's really hard to do. As I was working on the sermon this week, I was reading through some different commentaries, and one of my favorite commentators on the Gospel of John is a guy named Donald Carson. Carson's commentary is so detailed, and it's full of all kinds of very analytical kinds of things. But then he just made this real simple statement. I thought, you know, I want to share this with you today. He said that this passage is simple enough for a toddler to memorize, but it is profound enough for a mature believer to repeatedly be embarrassed at how poorly they comprehend it and put it into practice. Folks, we can all memorize this verse. We could go over it a few times. We'd walk out of here. We could quote it to everybody we meet. "A new command I give to you today, love as I have loved you." But it's altogether more difficult to put it into practice, isn't it? To actually begin to love the way Jesus loved, that's hard. That's really hard. And to be honest with you, some of us, if we were really just to take that seriously this morning, we'd be kind of embarrassed as we think about our week, how we treated some people. We haven't embodied or modeled this kind of love in the way that we should. Take the example of loving your neighbor. C.S. Lewis said one time, "Don't waste time bothering if you love your neighbor. Act as if you do." And he doesn't mean pretend. What he means is, look, what a lot of people do is, well, I don't like you, so I'm not going to love you. What he said is, no, you got it backwards. Love somebody first with your actions, and then your feelings are going to follow. M. Scott Peck is one of the most famous Christian psychologists. And he was analyzing Christian love and what Christian love is really like. He said, genuine love is this. It is volitional. The word means it has to do with your willpower. Genuine love is volitional rather than emotional. Real love is a decision. You know, you say, well, I don't really like that person. Well, when you're a Christian, how you feel about that person, what your emotions are about that person, you've got to set those aside and say, what is Jesus commanding me to do? What is the novum mandatum? It's to love like Jesus loved. And he gave us that model. Now, he didn't just give us the model. He then gives us, number three here, it's the message. Because what he does is he says, this is what I want you to do, and then he tells us why it matters. Verse 35, By this love that you have for one another, everyone will know that you're my disciples if you love one another. The title of our message today is The Sign of a Christian. And you know, if you were to go into many parts of the Middle East today, and some of you have been to those places, I've been to several different countries in the Middle East, and one of the things you'll sometimes see is people of different religions signifying it based on the jewelry they'll wear. Some of them will wear a cross, and you'll know they're a Christian. Some of them will be of another religion, and you'll see some symbol on that they have that indicates what religion they are. In the United States nowadays, I mean, in a lot of Western countries, it's popular to wear a cross around your neck. It's popular for people to have a Bible, and popular for people even to show up to church. But did you know that Jesus didn't say that any of those things indicate that you're a Christian? I mean, just being here this morning, I said, well, I'm a Christian because I'm at church. My parents were Christians. I must be a Christian. No, that's not really what Jesus says. Jesus says that by this, all men will know you're my disciples if you love one another. That the sign of really being a Christian is embodying this example, this model that Jesus gives in this passage. This is his message for us today. And if we want to just kind of break it down for our life, here's a couple things. One is this. This is the proof of our Christianity. It's the proof to ourselves. It's the proof to the people around us this morning. Hey, I'm really a Christian because I love... And he said, well, I don't know if I really agree with that. Well, I'm not sure that John, when the gospel was written, that the first readers of it agreed with it either. And the reason I think that they didn't agree with it is because he would then write three letters, 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John. In all of those, the theme repeats itself. It's kind of interesting. In 1 John, he'll say some things like this. 1 John 3:14, we know that we have passed from death to life. Now, most Christians would say, I know when I die, I'm going to go to heaven, and it's going to be great, and we know that we have passed from death to life, but look what he says, because we love each other. Now, you weren't expecting him to say that, right? Like, we know that we're a Christian. We know what our promise is. We know what our future is because we love each other. And then he says this, anyone who does not love remains in death. Here's another passage in 1 John 4:20. Whoever claims to love God yet hates a brother or sister is a what? A liar. In other words, if this morning we say, I'm a Christian, but I really hate this person or this group or whatever. Wait a minute, the Bible says that if you claim to love God, but you hate your brother or sister, you're a liar. For whoever does not love their brother or sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they've never seen. This is the proof of our Christianity. But it isn't just the proof for us, right? It isn't just to prove to ourselves who we really are. What about the world around us that's watching us? This is the second thing. This is the test to others to see if we really are Christians. That's how people will judge us as to whether or not we're really a Christian. I was reading through the sermon that Charles Spurgeon, the great British preacher, preached on this passage. And by the way, that sermon was long. Y'all better be glad I'm not preaching that one. Lots and lots, 7 points with sub-points, and he was just going on and on and on. It's hard for me just to read the thing. But he made the point in the sermon that he preached 120 years ago that the test in this passage is a test for fellow Christians to know if we really are Christians. But then he said, notice that Jesus says, by this all people will know. Not just Christians will know, but people who are not Christians. The outside world will look at us and say, well, I know you're a Christian because of your love. That's an incredible insight. One of the books that made a big deal out of this several years ago was a book written by a guy named Brennan Manning. It's called The Ragamuffin Gospel. There's a lot of quotes in that book, a lot of things in that book that were impactful of a lot of Christian people. But the quote that got repeated and repeated and repeated and still just absolutely is staggering to me to think about this morning is when he said this, that the greatest single cause of atheism in the world today is Christians who acknowledge Jesus with their lips but walk out the door and deny him by their lifestyle. This is what an unbelieving world simply finds unbelievable. Rick Warren used to say there are two reasons there aren't Christians in the world. Somebody hasn't met a Christian, or because they have met a Christian, and they don't want to have anything to do with Christianity. Spurgeon, in his sermon, told the story of his church, and they had had a big revival. All these people came in, and this lady who wasn't a Christian made her decision to become a Christian. Young lady. And she started coming to church. And she started being around some of the other Christian people. And she'd hear them say some things. And she'd see them do some things. And pretty soon she said, you know, I don't want to be around these people. They're not like Jesus. And he says she stopped coming to church. And it was an interesting observation, isn't it? Because it says here that by this all men will know that you're my disciples if you love. D.L. Moody, that Chicago evangelist and preacher from the 1800s, said, show me a church with love and I'll show you a church that has power in the community. I mean, people notice it. People stand up and pay attention to it. But you know, we need love not just because of an unbelieving world. We need love because we need love. The church should be a place of unparalleled affection for one another. Folks, it's time for people to have to stop going to other places to find love. It's time for people to have to stop going to sporting events to find people that love them because they share that in common. It's time for people to have to stop hanging out at bars and parties and to try to find people who love them. It's time for the church to become the place of unparalleled affection for one another, because Jesus said, by this, all men will know you're my disciples. The first church I pastored was a small little church, and there was a guy that lived in the community that was a really self-righteous guy, and you knew it because of the length of his beard, you know. And he would sit on the front row, not to criticize beards, because they're cool. I wish I could grow a big beard, but he would sit on the front row with his big King James Version Bible. I mean, I don't mean like, you know, little Bible. I mean, big ones. And he would listen to everything I said. He'd kind of eyeball me. I wouldn't even want to make eye contact with him, you know. After the sermon, he would make a beeline to me. And he would take apart everything I said in my sermon. He would criticize the way I said it, the things that I'd said. He spent longer criticizing me than I did preaching the sermon. And after about a year of this, I finally said to Roger one day, I said, Roger, I appreciate, you know, your attention to detail and your concern about all the different doctrinal truths and making sure everything is exactly right. I said, but do you know, I just know what Jesus said. And Jesus said that what really mattered most to him was not all those things, but it was if we love one another. And you could see his red complexion turn white as all of the blood vessels drained out of his face. And he was just shocked, not by the meanness, I didn't say it with any kind of meanness, but just by the truth of it. I didn't see Roger for a few months. And then one Sunday morning, I saw him come back. He was sitting not on the front row, but somewhere in the back. And he made a beeline for me again this time. And he said, David, I want to invite you to come eat lunch with me today. I've prepared a meal. I want you to come over to my house. I was kind of worried about it. You know, I was like, is it poison? I mean, what, you know, what's going to happen? We ate together. He gave me some books. I still have them, some classic books. Back one of them was an old D.L. Moody book. Roger and I became good friends. I believe that when he died, that he passed immediately into the presence of God. I learned something about that relationship. I learned that love can change people's hearts. That love can change people's lives. Real love, God kind of love. Thomas A. Kempis said, whoever loves much, does much. Several years ago, in the 1950s, I made the comment in the early service, in the historic 1950s, and I got a lot of criticism afterwards for making that comment. They're like, that's not history in the 1950s, because I was a kid. But in the 1950s, there was a researcher who'd gone into Africa, and he was interested in what happens to the little infants when they're born in these orphanages. And so he did a study. He went into a particular orphanage where when the babies were born, they were placed into hospital beds in sterile rooms, but they were completely isolated. His name was René Spitz, and he was a brilliant researcher. He studied these babies as they would get older, but then he went to make a kind of an analysis. He went into a prison where women were incarcerated and gave birth to their children right there in the prisons, in the dirty, filthy, smelly unbelievably unsanitary prisons and studied what happened to these infants in these different places. What he discovered would change the way hospitals would do, how they would handle children forever. He discovered that the babies that were isolated in these very sterile environments, 37% of them died. Of the ones who were born in the penitentiary but who could still be in contact with their mothers, 98% of them survived. And he made this incredible discovery that human beings, from the moment they're born, need to be loved to live. That love is not just something we want to have, love is something that we need. Isn't it amazing that God gave us the thing that we needed most when he said, "I so love the world, I gave my son"? And isn't it interesting that he said that the greatest command is that we love each other, and that the mandatum novum is that we love like Jesus loved.